Friends, as the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is why do good people suffer? And connected with it is the other question which we may as well ask, why do bad people suffer less or not suffer at all sometimes? Now, one simple, obvious answer could be given that good people suffer because of their awakened conscience. That it's quite possible for a person to do wrong and not feel anything about it. But a good person generally, when we say he's a good person, we say he must be also sensitive to right and wrong, to needs of other people. And therefore, when such a person does something wrong, there is that pricking of conscience. He feels he has done something wrong. And the state of such a person is very well described in the very first quotation in your handout, where Buddha says, the evildoer laments here, he laments hereafter. Evil have I done, he soliloquizes. Greater his torment when he is in the place of evil. But we know that this is not true of all people who do something wrong. There are thoroughly, thoroughly bad people who feel nothing having done anything wrong. For them, therefore, this subtle pain, this subtle torment, which is there for a good person, it is not there for them. Because they have gradually stifled their inner voice. The other thing then, why do good people suffer? If looked at in the light of the law of karma, which the first speaker already gave an outline about, is that if you do good, you get good result. If you do bad, you get bad result. And if some people don't even believe in karma, that is a different thing. But when you do try and understand suffering in terms of karma, then naturally you will ask that, what happens? This man has done something good, and why does he still suffer? So, it looks as if the law is obscure. It looks as if there is no justice, there is no mercy. It looks as if there is no God. Because God is all merciful and all powerful. And yes, there is the warped understanding of God also. A Christian writer, Professor C.S. Lewis, says that we have not understood correctly divine omnipotence and divine goodness. When we say God is all merciful and all powerful, people, many of them argue that if God is all merciful, then all creatures must be happy. And if he is all powerful, then he should be able to make all the creatures happy. If creatures are not happy, that means either he is not all merciful, or he is not all powerful, or both. Now, call it God, call it some power, or call it law. Any way, which way you look, this is not the right understanding of God. As he humorously says, we are not looking for Father in heaven, we are looking for Grandfather in heaven, who will only pamper the humanity and children, so that continuously they should have good time. But this is really not the understanding, as we are told that the true understanding of God or law is that he hurts in order to heal. And also if we feel that there is some God who is going to, because he is all merciful, he will miraculously take away our suffering or miraculously change the circumstances, this is something which will never happen. The only way in which the help of God can come is from within us. The God within us, the divine presence within us. So the second quotation says, it's only because that mankind has ever shut its eyes to the great truth that man is himself his own savior as his own destroyer. That this help will come from within. In what way? It will come in terms of strength, either to go through the suffering or in terms of strength to overcome the suffering. Now, at one place in the Secret Doctrine, H.P.B. quotes Dryden, who said, virtue in distress and vice in triumph makes atheists of man. And she says that is because people have not understood the laws of karma and rebirth. The first speaker pointed out that you have to take them together. Because karma gives only half the answer. So a person like the lady in Sound of Music says, nothing comes from nothing, nothing ever good. So somewhere in my youth or childhood, I must have done something good. But she stops in one life. Whereas sometimes it may so happen that a person is thoroughly good all his life, whatever 25, 30, 40 years, and you can't find a bad deed, which is also very rare. But then therefore you say that, why why does he suffer? Poor fellow. Or my parents who have been so good, why do they have to go through this? And that, as we are told by HPP, because we don't take into account the law of reincarnation. That we have lived before, and in some prior life, you may have done something wrong, of which the consequences you are suffering now. A story to that effect in Mahabharata, which should not be taken literally, is about Gandhari. You know, in Mahabharata, there is Queen Gandhari, and she loses 100 sons. And she asks Sri Krishna that, how is it that all my 100 sons are killed? And Krishna says, look back to your earlier lives. So she goes back, first life, second life, 50th life, and only in 51st life she is able to see that she, as a young girl, had poured water over anthill, killing 100 ants. Now this doesn't mean that if you kill 100 ants, you will lose 100 children. I mean, that's not the thing. As HPB at one place says, it just goes to show, allegorically, that sometimes when you are spiritually advanced, then you suffer dire consequences for trifling act. It's a small act. And yet, what the consequences you get back in terms of the law of karma are very severe. But here she was. She could not really find any reason in the given life, but there was something which was done in the past for which she was suffering. Now all of us are not really at that level where we can look into the past and therefore reconcile ourselves that, okay, this is the cause for which I am suffering. And therefore we must have faith in the law of karma and in the law of reincarnation. Likewise, it is true that a bad fellow who is now going scot-free, he seems to prosper and prosper. Again, the law says that in the subsequent life, in any of the subsequent life, he will get back the consequences for his action, which he may not get now. Because the law of karma, it works in such a way that two opposite kinds of effects cannot come to fruition at the same time. So we say that if you, under karma, have to take birth in the female body and experience motherhood, in the same life, obviously you can't really have the experience of fatherhood. Of course, these days they undergo sex change, it is a different thing. But ordinarily you can't. Also, if a person brings with him very good karma from the past, then he prospers. The bad karma is stored out, which comes to fruition in some other life. Therefore, let us not be impatient that why is it that this bad person does not suffer in spite of his evil? Because in some life, his karma will catch up with him. Now, the other answer, and that is the profound answer which we get in philosophy, that why do good people suffer? For that matter, why does anyone suffer? And the answer is, good people suffer because they are not spiritual yet. Ordinarily, when you meet people, some of them are very nice. They have lots of virtues. But in our eyes, maybe they are too good. Some of them we look upon them as being very holy, etc., etc. But it's one thing to be a good person. It's quite another thing to be spiritual. And that is why, you see, the next quotation, we will skip that other quotation, which says that law never errs, it brings back the consequences. The fourth quotation says, remember, O disciple, that great though the gulf may be between good man and the sinner, it is greater between the good man and the man who has attained knowledge. It is immeasurable between good man and the one on the threshold of divinity. So there is that height of spirituality towards which we are being driven. Life is pushing us to higher and higher levels. Life is pushing us to a point where we will learn to make choices. Choices between good and evil. That's why Bible says, blow hot or blow cold, the lukewarms I spew out of my mouth. Most of the time, ordinary people, they go through life waveringly. Sometimes when it suits us, we are good. When it doesn't suit us, it pinches us, we don't mind doing wrong. But life sees to it that we take evolution into our own hands. And we make definite choices. Choices for good or choices for evil. And then definite reaction comes. Now, it is because we are pushed in this direction, in the process of growing, we experience pain. there is a parable which is what is narrated by a Christian writer, Jelena Gomes. It's called the parable of canyons, which is found in Ralph Connor book. The parable of the canyon, it was narrated by originally by a mountain priest. There used to be mountain priests, and he observes nature and he then constructs these parables. So he narrates it to a girl who was rebellious. Every time something did not go according to her women fancy or according to her expectation, she would rebel. She would rebel and grumble. So this mountain priest, when she loses one of her foot, then at that time she is grumbling a lot. And this mountain priest narrates this tale, or rather the parable of canyon, which is about the prairies. There was a time when there were no canyons, only prairies were there, where open wide field of tall, tall grasses. The master of the prairies, he sees it and he feels there should be a few flowers growing here. So he asks the birds to carry seeds. And now, of course, the wild roses and sunflowers, etc., begin to grow there. And yet he is not happy. He feels that those flowers which he loves the best also need to grow here, like the lilies and daffodils and violets, etc. So now he asks the birds to carry those seeds. And now, again, those flowers bloom, but they immediately wither under the scorching sun. So then we are told that the master asked the lightning to cleft the prairies, and therefore, as it were, a gaping wound is produced. And we are told for days on end, the prairies groans. The prairies is tormented, and it moans in pain and agony over this gaping wound which is produced within itself. Of course, as a result of this kind of a depression which is created, now the rivers are able to carry water, and now those flowers which used to wither away now remain for a long time blooming. And that is why, look what Jelena Gomes says, it's a parable which has a message that left to ourselves, none of us would like to be cleft and have gaping wounds. But there are sometimes strokes of lightning in our lives. We are struck by pain, illness, misunderstanding, and ever so often rejection. Then virtues which could not flower under comfortable circumstances of life begin to develop under adversities. Virtues of gentleness and courage, sympathy and endurance, patience and sacrificial love. So it's only in adversities that these virtues can really flower forth. Something to the same effect comes in an article, Advantages and Disadvantages of Life, in Vernon Bloom's. There's a book on the book table where Mr. Judge points out that there are plenty of those who are rich, comfortable. For them, there is travel to different countries. There are best teachers for them. Well, they will also have the advantage of going to the music concerts and movies and art and culture. Many of them really develop a good character. Most of the time, too much of this comfort and luxury, it works like eating too much sweet, which turns to acid in the body. It's like the tropical airs which enervate the body, and so too much comfort enervates the soul. It all begins in the brain and ends in the brain. At the end of life, you hardly carry any of these comforts and luxury and enjoyments with you. Whereas, he says, a person who has been deprived of the comforts of life, he had to toil and struggle for most part of his life. What happens in this case? Imagine the brain and body not in places of ease, struggling for a good part of life, doing their duty, not in a position to please the senses. This experience will burn in, stamp upon, carve into the character more energy, more power, and more fortitude. It is thus through the ages that great characters are made. For really building a great character, a deep-reaching character with the virtues, with courage and etc., such virtues, you need to have gone through pain. It just doesn't come in the comforts and luxury, not mostly, we would say. And that is why we are told that pain as HPB says, is necessary for growth. And that's our next quotation. Woe to those who live without suffering. Stagnation and death is the future of all that vegetates without a change. And how can there be any change for the better without proportionate suffering during the preceding stage? This we find. One of the books on the book table called Through the Gates of Gold says, pain softens and pain arouses. It makes us ask questions of life. Why me? What am I here for? What is the purpose of life? And it also softens. At times, a person who has undergone a lot of pain tends to become sympathetic. There is the example, or rather the incident, of a doctor in a concentration camp. This is in a book, Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. He tells us that this doctor, he was satanic. He was the one who used to be almost ruthless and heartless doctor. But at the end, after a few years, when the German and the Russia and Germany had war, some of these people were taken captive and held prisoner. This doctor was one of them. And in the prison, we are told that he suddenly got the cancer of urinary bladder. Now, it's a very painful thing. After passing through that pain, the fellow prisoner who used to watch him, he saw a radical change come about in this doctor. Now he would go and comfort other prisoners, give them encouragement and hope. And he says, the prisoner says, I've never seen such a kind person in all my life. The one who was ruthless before, after undergoing the pain of that cancer of urinary bladder, probably his eyes were open to the sufferings of other people. And here he was, the most kind and sympathetic person, who then died as a completely changed person. So, pain is necessary for growth. But let us not think that pain ensures growth. It doesn't mean that a person who has seen a lot of pain all through the life is going to be the wisest person, he's going to be the best person, most sympathetic person. Pain does not automatically bring about this change. It is our response to pain. We need to learn from pain. It's only when we learn the lesson from pain that we grow. It is not that more pain means more growth. It is not so. And this we know very well. Because what happens when we are undergoing pain? We suffer even little. Then at the end of it, well, when we are passing through it, we pass through it, and then when it is over, we'll say, I want to forget the whole incident like a bad dream. And I hope I am never put into that situation ever again. Now, the very fact that we are afraid of being put into the same situation again so shows we have not really understood why it happened to me. We have not really tried to learn the lesson which that situation was trying to teach us. That is why. Had we learned the lesson, we would not be afraid to go through it over again. So, we have not learned. We've just passed through that experience without really extracting the essence of that experience. Take a simple thing. This is very simple. Someone who eats lots of ice creams and then he has bad cold, maybe fever, suffers for 10 days, all blocked nose and all that. What you say, generally we all say to ourselves, never again. I'm never going to have these 4 or 5 ice creams which I had. And then maybe after 2 months, 3 months, that memory is gone. Again, you are faced with, in a party, you see lovely all flavors of ice cream. I'll have 1, 2, 3. You repeat the same folly once again. And once again, you are put into the painful situation. So, very correctly, Mr. Crosby says in one of his little writings, that we are like a cat. When cat is out in the cold night, she will scratch on your door and mew to be taken inside. But once inside and comfortable, she loses all memory of that pain in the cold night. Once again, after 15 minutes, she will scratch at the door to be again let out in the cold night once again. And he says that some of us come perilously close to this animal existence. We don't really look close at the pain, and that is why. That is why life puts us sometimes into the same situation over and over again. Many people would have, if you go inspect your life, closely, you will find that why is it that this is the kind of situation in which I am put over and over again? Why it is this kind of, with some it is bodily pain, with some it is emotional pain. Why am I put into this situation? It's because we have not really learned the lesson. We need to change and we have not brought about that necessary change. But life or our higher nature is a tough taskmaster. It's not satisfying if we say, if we had to learn patience and if we have learned say 50%, it's not satisfying. Our higher nature will put us into situations where again and again it becomes necessary for us to learn patience. And unless we master it 100%, we are not easily going to be let off. Similarly, other virtues. In fact, unless we have 100% perfection in all direction, in all virtues and in all direction, we will find that hardly have we come out of one situation, one adversity, you find yourself in another situation. You come out of one temptation and you are faced with another temptation. Because we need to keep on learning lessons and grow. Now, this is something very, very important. And as again, Professor C.S. Lewis says, very humorously he says, that life sometimes is something which he experienced for his toothache. He says that whenever I used to have toothache, my mother will say, I'll take you to a dentist. Now, I won't mind going, but I knew that once I was taken to the dentist, not only would he pull the tooth which was paining, but he would fiddle around with all my other teeth to see if any other was developing decay or was moving. And then he would give me a full treatment. And he, being a Christian author, says that this is how God is. He doesn't leave you easily, he gives you full treatment. He sees what other aspects are of our life or our character are weak, and that is where we are then tested. So, once you learn the lesson, it is equally true, when the lesson is learned, the necessity ceases. You know, if you are afraid of dark, but you overcome the fear, and then if you have to go in the dark 50 nights, it's not really painful or fearsome or nothing. The lesson is learned, the necessity ceases. But we don't learn the lesson very quickly. And learning the lesson means the first step is acceptance. Accept the woes of birth. What generally happens is we begin to grumble. Why does it have to happen to me? What have I done to deserve this? And in that process, we miss out the lesson. And the real this thing is to accept. In fact, we can bear in mind that little prayer which is so pregnant. It says, God, grant me the serenity to take the things I cannot change. Courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. This is where the crux lies. It's not as if we have to go through any pain which falls on us quietly without doing anything, and it is not as if we have to grumble. But there is this fine line which we have to realize, that in which situation I will have to really fight against and change it, and in which situation I will have to timidly accept and go through it valiantly without really complaining. And then see what lesson the situation has to teach me. This other thing also in learning the lesson. You know, one individual can't really go through all possible experiences of life. So, there's something like sympathetic imagination. You learn from other people's experiences. And this is where we also fail once again. There are lives of people around us. Things happen, they are reported in the newspaper, we read it as news and pass it by. How many times we really pause and think what it means to be raped at the age of 10? What does it mean to not have both the eyes and be blind and live that helpless life? What does it mean to undergo or suffer great financial loss? What does it mean to lose all your near and dear ones? This may be in the newspaper, in the magazine. It can be people who are around us. But have we really cultivated that sympathy so that we, through imaginative sympathy, can get under their skin, get into their shoes and know what it feels to be in these situations? If we really did that, then when the pain comes to us, we would be better able to handle it. In fact, again, Professor Lewis is the one who, when he was married to this woman only for I think 10 months or a year, very little time, and he was so attached to her that after that when she died, he was completely shattered. He couldn't cope with the loss. He has written a whole book called A Grief Observed. And in that, at one place he says, why do I feel so helpless? Why am I not able to grapple with this pain? And he says, probably because when other people around me were losing their near and dear ones, maybe I didn't sympathize enough with them. It was like, okay, it's happened. You go, you moan, half an hour, come back, and you are back into your own life. So had I done that, if I did not have this lukewarm attitude, probably today I would have that capacity to deal with my pain. So this learning from pain, your own and others, this is the opportunity given by life. And Mr. Jack says that if we are open to other people's suffering and the way their lives are led, in one life you will have advantage of having lived several lives. You know, something which you would go through in other lives, in this very one life you can learn all that. But we don't do that. Now coming back to, we said good people suffer because they are not spiritual, but then who is a spiritual person? And a simple definition comes in Buddhism. They say a spiritual person is the one who combines Mahapragna and Mahakaruna, great spiritual insight and great compassion. He doesn't have only knowledge, he also has compassion. We may add and say a spiritual person is one who is reached extinction of desire. A spiritual person is one who has risen above the pairs of opposites, heat and cold, likes and dislikes, pain and pleasure. Immediately we are able to see that very rarely, if ever, we come across even the so-called good person showing these characteristics. Most of us have some desire or the other, some attachment or the other. We have not yet grown above the pairs of opposites. And very little compassion is really developed in us. And nor do we have complete knowledge. So in this transition from being good people to becoming spiritual people, it's a thorny way where we are going to experience pain. And one of the things in Buddhism which is said is that the very first step in the Noble Eightfold Path is Samyak Drishti, or which is called perfect vision. What the voice of the silence says, right perception of existing things. Perfect vision. Now what does it mean? Perfect vision is being able to see the nature of our existence. Are we aware? The nature of manifestation? Buddhism says that there are three characteristics of this conditioned life that we live. We pass through this experience, but we have not really noticed. We have not really realized and imbibed and internalized that there is these three characteristics of conditioned existence. It says, Sabbe Dhamma Dukkha, Sabbe Dhamma Anitya, Sabbe Dhamma Anatma. All conditioned existence is full of suffering. In fact, Buddha says, sorrow is. There is the parable where Buddha, when a woman brings a little child that is dead to Buddha and asks him that restore him back to life. And Buddha doesn't say anything. He only says, go and get me few mustard seeds from a house where no death has taken place. Now, she goes and comes back empty-handed saying that there is not a single house where no death has taken place. So, death happens. And with death comes also sorrow for those who are left behind. So, dukkha is part of the conditioned existence. So also, sabbe dhamma anitya. Everything is changing. Everything is impermanent. And sabbe dhamma anatma. That all conditioned existence is devoid of true selfhood. Now, this dukkha or pain is there. Right from our birth, growing up, then old age, sickness and death. Who wouldn't have experienced this pain if not any other? There is pain which arises from likes and dislikes, you know, the attachments we have, the desires we have. That is why one of these next quotations in the second page says, what grief springs of itself and springs not of desire? Senses and things perceived mingle and light, passions, quick spark of fire. This is one kind of pain which we also experience again and again. It's simple things. You put one spoon of ice cream on your tongue and the tongue reports it is sweet. But the mind says, it's nice, I like it and I want more of it. So the craving has come from the sensation. You are passing by and soon you see a nice sari or maybe a nice some clothes. Eyes report it to the mind and the mind says, oh, it's lovely, I want it. So desire is what then gives rise to pain in different ways. It is not only if the desire is not satisfied that you will be painful. Even when the desire is satisfied, it's quite possible, as they say, after getting it, it all turns to dust and ashes in the mouth. You know, the boy may be running after a girl for many years. After marrying, he finds, oh no, she's not the way what I thought her to be. And it all turns to dust and ashes in the mouth. Or even if you desire and get what you wanted, you want to hold on to it forever and ever. And that is not possible in this conditioned existence where everything is impermanent. And that is why when Buddhism says sorrow is, it's not trying to say that therefore there is no pleasure in life. All that it says is that even lurking behind the pleasure is suffering. There is a concealed suffering. As a poet has said, we look before and after and pine for what is not. Our sincerest laughter but with some pain is fraught. That always there is an underlying current of suffering because of this impermanence of life. And as a result, we find that if you are attached to a person, if you are attached to an object, there's always a constant fear, constant anxiety. Anytime it can be snatched away. Again, an illustration is given that a hawk, suppose he finds a big piece of meat and he flies with it, feeling very happy that once I find a secure place, I start eating. But what happens? Soon he finds that hundreds of other hawks will be flying behind him. Some will peck at his body, some will peck at his eyes to snatch away that piece. Now this is what we experience in life. The competitive world that we live in, this happens all the time. You have got promotion, you've got money, you've got comforts. There's always somebody trying to drag you down. There is always anxiety of income tax raid, anxiety of losing your money, your position, your power. So this is what is called as potential suffering. Something which is giving you pleasure now, that same thing will become a source of pain. And also, there is a pain coming as a result of running after sensation. When we have good, pleasant sensation, what happens? You want to repeat it. And we think that by repeating it, I'm going to get more pleasure. But that is not the truth. You eat one ice cream, you eat second ice cream, you eat third ice cream, and the fourth ice cream you eat, that pleasure begins to diminish. First time you have gone to Switzerland is one thing. But then, every now and then, the person who is going abroad, ask him, and he'll say, oh, it's routine. It's not that pleasant. So, there is a law of diminishing return in our pleasures. And probably in certain pleasures like drinking alcohol, taking drugs. In fact, it is called the mocking demon of illusion. That it doesn't give you pleasure any longer. It seems to mock and say, leave me if you can. You are not able to. You just go after it. And that's painful actually. So this is also a pain. Now, we said that the good people suffer because they are not spiritual. Now let us not get the idea that therefore spiritual people do not suffer and they do not even enjoy. That is to say, they are stoics. Nothing happens to them. You kill them, you hurt them, they will lose their near and dear ones. No pain. That is not the meaning of spiritual people not suffering. What is really meant by becoming spiritual and not suffering? It means that, in fact, the more spiritual you are, the more sensitive you become. The more you become aware of pleasure and pain, not only your pleasure and pain, but pleasure and pain of another person. But you do not allow that pleasure and pain to shake you from your work, from your fixed purpose. You do not allow that pleasure or pain to influence your thinking or your decision. What happens for ordinary man? And this is a simple example which all of us must have really sometime or the other gone through. Sometimes you are so happy, you go to office and maybe you are the boss in the company and a subordinate comes and says, sir, I want to go home early today, can I go at 4? You are in a happy mood, so you say, you don't have to ask, you can go even at 3:30 or 3. Now, after a few days, when you are in a depressed mood and you go to office and another person comes, same request is made, but now your reaction is different. You are so depressed. You are unhappy. And so you will say, no going home early. You will just brush aside his request. Or if the mistake is made in a happy mood, you will condone. When you are not in a happy mood, you will make a big issue out of it. So we are not able to see things clearly when we are in pain. It seems to, as it were, color our thinking, color our faculty of discrimination and decision making. We are not really able to think straight under pain. We are shaken. Sometimes we are shattered. Now, this is not the thing which will happen with a spiritual. Why? Because one aspect of his consciousness is completely involved in pain. But there is that another aspect of consciousness which is able to remain as a witness and an observer. So, while on one hand he is involved, but on the other hand he is also a witness to whatever is happening. He is able to dissociate himself from pain or pleasure. And that is why in the book Light on the Path we are told that you have to maintain your balance and equilibrium, not only on level ground, not only on high places, but also on the level ground. We are asked actually to maintain psychological balance. We are able to stand or we are able to walk. Why? Because as science teaches, the perpendicular from the center of gravity of the body falls within the base of support, that is between the 2 feet. But if you bend too much forward or if you bend too much backward, what happens? Then that perpendicular falls outside the base of support and then you tend to lose your balance and fall down. This is exactly what happens also psychologically. Our psychological base of support is our divine nature, which gives us the sense of I. But when we are completely identified with a pleasant situation or a painful situation, as we said, you are identified. It is as if that situation is whole of you. You are identified with it and therefore your sense of I goes awry. You are no longer identifying yourself with that self within you. And then sometimes we see that some people, they go mad, insane, with too much pain or too much sudden pleasure. He gets lottery or he loses in the share market. Other cases, possibility is there that he can really go mad because he is completely identified with the situation. Whereas we have to realize that this is not me. Dissociate the I from the situation and fall back upon that real self which is within us. In the Gita, that self which is unaffected by everything is called Kutastha. It's a Sanskrit word. And the etymology of the word is Kuta, meaning not only complex, difficult to understand, but Kuta also means anvil, anvil of a blacksmith. And Stha, it is stable to sit. So there is that in man which is stable like the anvil of the blacksmith. You know, you would have seen a blacksmith. He gives different shapes to pieces of iron on that anvil. But the anvil itself remains unshakable, unchanged, on which changes keep on happening to the pieces of iron. So also there is that in you which is unaffected by pleasure or pain. All we need to do is identify yourself with that aspect. And this is not simple, but this is what we need to attempt. As the next quotation says, the thought pattern during the suffering hinges around, I'm unhappy. In the state of unhappiness, what happens is that one's personality gets totally identified with one's emotional layer. The fact is that I can observe my body. I can also observe my emotions and my ideas. Now the exercise is to stand apart as a mere witness of the pain. With a little continuation of this self-effort, one dissociates the I from the unhappiness. How long will the thoughts remain unhappy without the cooperation of the I? It is the mind that suffers, not I. The I has become a witness. To give a simple example, a mother, you know, when she would have headache, the children would say, why do you work? You are having such a bad headache. And that lady would say, the head is doing its work, I am doing mine. This is a dissociation. Head, so that headache is not me, whereas all the time we say, I have a headache. And already we feel that I am that headache, and you are completely involved in that headache. Whereas here there is a dissociation. Head is paining, but an aspect of my consciousness continues to do work which is required of me. This is a simple example, but we know people can dissociate themselves from terrible pain. As we say, they rise to the occasion. They do not bother about that pain, and in fact go and help others. And this is the crux. We may ask that, how do you really dissociate yourself? One of the things, or one of the methods of doing, is create that bond between your inner nature. Regular meditation, where you sit down for meditation, you are, as it were, creating a link with your higher nature, and your higher nature becomes like your friend, like asylum, like a resting place. Or by listening to the voice of conscience within. All the time there is a voice guiding us. Don't do this, do this, this is right, this is wrong. The more you pay heed to it, the more is the link forged with this higher nature. The other, a little simpler method, is to overcome, not get identified and overwhelmed by our suffering, is to immediately devote yourself to some noble cause, to another suffering. That is the best way of taking your attention away from your suffering. Again, to go back to the concentration camp example, here Viktor Frankl, who was a part of the concentration camp, tells us that, I saw some people in concentration camp, that they would go from person to person, consoling them, even sharing the last morsel of food which was there, when they saw someone was hungry. And one thing struck me at that point, that you can take everything from a man, except one thing, and that is his attitude. His attitude to circumstances. It is very much in his own hands whether he should wallow in the grief and get carried away, or remain aloof, watching it as a passing phase, and in fact go and help another. As they say, you can create heaven in hell's despair. The story comes to our mind from, probably you would have read it, from The Chicken Soup for the Soul, where we are told about two patients in a same room. One of them was suffering from terminal illness and would not last long. And the other one was on another bed, but he was, as it were, not able to move. He is barely able to sit in the bed. The person who was terminally ill was near the window. And he sees that this fellow is all the time down in despair. So he thinks that, let me do something. So he would look out of the window and tell this man what was there outside in the world. So he would say, there is a lake, there are children coming to play, now they are making boats and sailing them there, now there are flowers here, and a vivid description would be given, and this person for half an hour would be in good cheer. Now the person thinks that, why not, if this guy was not there, my bed could be shifted and I can have the view myself. Now, as it happens, this man dies. So immediately he has his bed shifted near the window, and immediately he gets up, sits up, and looks outside the window, and what does he see? A blank wall. There was nothing outside. There was only a blank wall. But this terminally ill patient, forgetting his own sorrow, through his vivid imagination, he tried to keep the other man in good cheer. So this is what is meant by not allowing the suffering to get the better of us. We can do this. And that is what we mean, that why do good people suffer? They suffer because they allow themselves to suffer. Why does anyone suffer? Because you allow yourself to really, get that pain the better of you. Also, the second thing is, important thing is, that you are able to go through life, a painful life, sometimes lonely life, a depressed life, when you set for yourself a future. A little purpose is there. Or at least imagine that my living can serve purpose at any future point. Though at present I feel, why do I live? What's the use of my living? But I don't know. I could be of help to someone. And sometimes, whether we know it or not, you can radically change another's life. Quite unknowingly. By your just simple deed of kindness. What comes to us is again another story with which we will stop. Is the incident about a boy who had to pay for his education by going from door to door selling his goods. Now, he goes like this, but one day he is completely exhausted, he has not eaten food for long, and he has no money. He is hoping that someone would give him food, and in fact he is hoping that the next door he goes to, he will shamelessly ask for food over there. When he rings the bell, unfortunately, a very lovely lady opens, a lovely girl opens the door, and this young person is hesitant. So he says, please give me a glass of water. But the girl was very sensitive. So she comes back with a glass of milk. He drinks it, and suddenly, not only is he feeling nourished, but his faith in humankind and his faith in God is restored back. And he says, how much do I owe you? And the girl says, my mother has taught me never to charge anyone for the kindness that you show. So he goes, and after a few years, we are told that this girl grows into a lovely young lady, and she suffers from a fatal disease. In that little township, there is no doctor who can cure. So they suggest a doctor's name in a big city. She shifted there, and the doctor is told that a lady has come from a certain town. And this doctor's eyes light up. And he feels probably it could be that girl. And he goes to see her and immediately recognizes. And of course cures her. He is a big doctor, renowned doctor, in a big city. And the girl knows, I can't afford to pay his bill. But, and the doctor also knows. The doctor says, send the bill to me for scrutinizing. And at the end of the bill he writes, paid in full with one glass of milk. Now that is a karmic part. But the important part is, did this girl know when she was handing over the glass of milk to this person that she's going to radically change this person's life? Who was thinking that if I don't get food now, I quit. I'm done with life. With that one glass of milk, which is a simple gesture, she has brought about a radical change and given to the world a good doctor in turn. So, this is maybe some of the attitudes which we can cultivate towards pain. We are sorry we have exceeded time. The last two things are important. Dostoevsky, who says, there is only one thing that I dread, not to be worthy of my suffering. And Nietzsche, who says, he who has a why to live for can bear with almost any harm. Concentration camp people, some of them could pull through because many felt that we'll go out and tell the world that you can pass through even this kind of suffering. Many could go through because they said that we'll go out and tell the world what kind of torture state is. Some could pull through because they wanted to meet their near and dear ones. So there was a purpose, there was a goal which was assigned by themselves, to themselves, and that is why they could carry on even through the worst sufferings of the concentration camp. We have maybe 2 to 3 minutes for questions.
Catching up with these ideas of karma, reincarnation,
And those who keep an open mind, well, they would accept it. After all, we are told that they are very logical. Simple one question, which we can ask ourselves, that otherwise how are we going to explain the suffering in the world? For instance, how is it that some children are born in poverty, even they are congenitally blind or handicapped, and some children are, say, born in the rich families and with healthy bodies and all? Are we going to say that that is because of the will of God? If that is will of God, and if you say that God is merciful, then how is it that that same merciful God has created some to undergo such suffering and others to really have this kind of a very comfortable life? So we are then really we don't have any answer. We can also have to, otherwise we might say that it's chance. But we don't find that even in the physical world. Do we think that the world is running by chance? No. We see that there is a law operating in physics, in chemistry. Even simple things like sun rising in the east and setting in the west. The water that you touch doesn't feel cold one day and it will burn your finger the next day. No. So there is law. And if there is law at one realm, in the physical realm, we also have laws at the psychological, emotional levels also we would have. Then why not in this unseen realm? So there again, logically we can accept. Yes, there is no proof. No concrete proof can be given in terms of there is reincarnation. Karma we can give. As you sow, so shall you reap. That if you sow the seeds of mango, you are not going to get tomorrow coconuts out of it. No. So mango seeds and mango will come. But the problem arises because we don't know the cause. And problem arises in taking the concept of reincarnation. There again, some of them in the West, like Dr. Ian Stevenson, he has written a book wherein he has given more than 100 examples of children who could remember their past lives. Theosophy does not take this as a conclusive proof. But many people take this as a conclusive proof, where many children, they could recall what they were in the past, and people have gone and verified those things and found to be true. So if you don't really want to go logically, there is this proof. And also, main thing is to realize there is something which survives the body. Now, are we not having enough number of things showing us that there is something surviving the body in terms of OBEs and NDEs, out of the body experience and near death experience? This is science telling. If we are wanting to have scientific proof, then science is also accepting it, that there is an out of the body experience where the person comes out of the body, he watches his body, things happen to the body, and then again he re-enters the body. And therefore there is something apart from the body which is there. Near-death experiences, Raymond Moody's book Life After Life, again there are more than 20-25 examples of people who nearly died and came back. And their description, if you see, again you feel everything doesn't end with the end of the body. Something survives. I mean, we can go on because we've sometimes had whole lectures on reincarnation. But this is to give an example that yes, people are slowly, even those who did not believe, have begun to believe. Now, to begin with, there was 0%. We are told in the West now 30% people are believing in rebirth and reincarnation. Because there is logic and there is this indirect proofs which are coming to us in terms of something surviving the body. If there is nothing, we'll close.